Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inform, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. And you can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org/inform. And I am Laura Seidel. I'm an arts correspondent with National Public Radio. Joining me tonight is Reza Aslan. He's a political commentator, New York Times bestselling author, and an analyst for CBS News. Aslan is considered by some to be an American window to Islam. Fellow cultural bridge workers, joining him tonight are Zoe Ferraris, author of Finding Nuf and City of Veils, Wajahat Ali, playwright of the groundbreaking The Domestic Crusaders, and photographer, poet, and co-founder of the Lowbrow Society for the Arts, Navja Sol. So let's greet them and give them a warm welcome. So, Reza, I want to start with you, since it's really your book, I think, that inspired this panel. Your new book is a compendium of 100 years of writing out of the Middle East. Why did you put this book out right now? Why did you bring all these writers together?
Well, I mean, the easy answer is to say that these are titans of global literature that are internationally famous, but which most English speakers are completely unaware of. But there is another purpose here, too, and that has to do with the way in which I think most people in North America and Europe view the Middle East, really solely through the lens of either religion or politics. And the only voices that we ever hear from this region are the voices of the powerful and the elite, the religious and political leaders. And anyone who spent even a moment in the Middle East knows the chasm of opinions and ideas and mores and values and ambitions and aspirations that separate the people of this diverse region from the leaders of this diverse region. And, you know, it occurred to me that the only way that we can get past the noise and actually hear from the people in the Arab world or the people in Iran or in Turkey or in South Asia is through literature. Because the truth of the matter is that this is a region of the world where, for the most part, freedoms of speech, freedoms of the press are severely curtailed, if not just sometimes, you know, downright forbidden. And in such societies, the poet, the writer, becomes the journalist, becomes the revolutionary, becomes the historian, becomes the social critic. And literature becomes a tool to criticize society, becomes a mirror that you can point to society and to expose its weaknesses and its failures. Because there's really no one else in these societies who has that ability, which is, by the way, why the poets and the writers in this region and so many of those collected in tablet and pen are either currently in prison or have been in prison.
And there are certain themes in this, you know, dealing with imperialism that run all the way through and a very complicated relationship with the West, I think, that you see kind of developing right from the beginning.
Yeah, one of the most fascinating things that you learn when you read this book is the way in which literature has been used throughout the region as a means of forming identity. I mean that quite literally. The book is from 1910 to 2010, and it's put together in a sort of a narrative arc so that, you know, one of the complaints that I always have about anthologies is that no one actually reads an anthology, you just kind of taste it in little bits. And so what I wanted to do was put together an anthology that actually read as one sustained book from the beginning to the end. And when you read it in that way, what you recognize very quickly is that for most of these people, literature became a way of constructing a firm national identity. It became a way of saying what it actually meant to be an Arab or Persian or a Turk or Pakistani. These works and these writers, these poets, they really shaped, they provided the intellectual foundation for the modern states of the Middle East. It was their words that helped fashion an identity to push back against European colonialism and Western imperialism. Now, the irony is that for the most part, many of these same writers whose works gave birth, you know, to the modern Middle East very quickly became the enemies of the states that they helped found.
I mean, it's interesting. You begin in the book, you begin each section with a little bit of history. So the writing actually becomes a window into what it must have felt like as particular events are going on. You actually begin the book, though, talking about Napoleon, which
right.
was and the sort of picture of Napoleon with the Sphinx.
Yeah, it's a little story I tell from when I was in high school, and my world history book had this picture that I will never forget, and it was a picture of Napoleon sitting astride a horse face to face with the Sphinx. In Egypt. This was, of course, after the French invasion of Egypt. And what was really remarkable about that whole experience is that Napoleon showed up not just with an army, but with an army of so-called savants, anthropologists, sociologists, writers, artists, whose job was to get to know the natives, to understand, you know, the Orient, as they referred to it, which, of course, is not a geographic designation. It's a moral designation. It's a civilizational designation. It's meant to mean anything that is not Europe. That's what the Orient means. And as a result, they produce this really quite marvelous work. It's called The Description of Egypt. And that became sort of foundational in Europe for understanding the Middle East. And that I use that as sort of a metaphor to explain how pretty much everything we know about this region, we know through the lens of Europe or the West. And that's understandable because, like I said, I mean, really, we read history books written by scholars. You know, we watch television and we hear the voices of the leaders of the region. There's no avenue that we have that allows us direct contact with these people except for literature, except for the arts. That's the only path available to us. That's the only way that we can break down these boundaries and borders that separate us. I just came back from Israel a little while ago, and I was having a conversation with an Israeli friend of mine. And, you know, like a stupid American, I was saying, well, you know, if the Israelis and the Palestinians can just sort of get to know each other, you know? You just sit down and have a coffee and get to know each other.
And what did he say? We do know each other?
His response, right. His response
they
was,
live together.
No, so you don't understand. We know each other very, very well. That's why we hate each other. And while that may be true, the important thing to understand is that they know each other as symbols, not as human beings. They know each other as different religions, as different ethnicities, as different nationalities. What literature does is it provides a way to break through those boundaries. So even in Israel-Palestine, they read each other's movies. They watch each other's movies. They read each other's books. They listen to each other's music. The arts becomes the only path that these two people who claim to know each other so well can truly understand each other. And that, I think, is ultimately the purpose of the book.
Now, I mean, with us here, we have a panel of people who are all American-born. And I guess we're sort of segueing in a way into diaspora literature here. And here, you know, in two cases, you had families who walked into this culture, which has very particular ideas about Muslims, about people from the Middle East. And in fact, we just had, you know, a situation in Portland where a young Somali immigrant was arrested. And you have all these ideas, I think, building up about who immigrants are, probably a lot of fear. And we have authors here who, Wajahat Ali, has actually written about an immigrant family from Pakistan, and I think giving us a certain amount of insight into that. And one of the things that really struck me about it, reading it myself, too, was I had not read much literature about what it was like to be a Pakistani American. And as I read it, I thought to myself, oh, this is the immigrant story. They really have a lot of the same issues that every immigrant family to the United States has. And I wonder if you can talk a little about how you came up with the characters in this play. I know we were talking before and you said, this is not my family.
Right. Well, my mother's here in the audience, so she'll be the first one to tell you that she's not the mother in the play. Growing up with a multi-syllabic personality, one always assumes and asks, how can you be both Muslim and Pakistani and American? Is there a mutual exclusivity? Do you turn off the Muslim and turn on the Pakistani and the American? Do you turn off the Pakistani and turn on the American? And for those of us who I think are part of that generation, I think it's first and foremost is a very American identity to be a mosaic identity. All of us will tell you the only way to be it is to be fluid. I am simultaneously a Muslim, American, Pakistani. I don't know how to be anything else. So I will be wearing my shirt as a 10-year-old with a turmeric stain of my mom's dal, and I will be trying to, Google Winona Ryder because I had a crush on her, and then I'll be eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and, I'll be trying to learn Spanish to impress a girl who would never talk to me. And that, again, is a very American experience. And when researching for the play, when people said, then how'd you pick out these characters? And I said, I merely sat down and I listened and I remembered. I remembered the voices that were around me growing up. I remembered my friends who were Jewish American, I went to an all-boys Catholic school. Imagine that, being a Muslim American all-boys Catholic school. And a great experience. And what I learned, as Reza was saying, is when I read the Bible and I read these stories for the first time, I said, wow, Christians and Muslims have a lot in common. And I sat there in this experience of being a multi-hyphenated, multi-syllabic, multicultural person living in the Bay Area. It informed the characters in the play, who are not caricatures or cardboard stereotypes. They're very complex. They're very hypocritical. They're very unique. They're different. They have a unique ideological viewpoint. And some of them can be conservative and religious. Some of them can be very progressive and be religious. And, there's no one monolithic identity. And that's what I wanted to represent.
It strikes me, they're very much in it, dealing with the idea of the American dream. The first generation, the parents who are here, they come here, they want their kid to be a doctor.
Right.
And that's, this is so typical. And of course, the young people are becoming Americanized, and worrying about things like, oh, I want to go off, I want to be a writer, I want to do other things. And this is all very typical. And it's really just more about coming from a traditional place, coming to the United States, dealing with this at the same time, though, they're also dealing with the stereotypes around them. And you managed to bring all of that into this play rather beautifully.
Well, thank you.
I wonder if you could talk, though, a little bit about the idea that you were dealing with these basic ideas
right.
of what it's like to be an immigrant family. Right. But in this case, more than typical, you're dealing with a culture around you that has really pretty bad stereotypes right now. About Pakistanis, about Muslims. And it seems it does affect the people in the play deeply.
It has to, because many people say, well, how can we, sometimes when I wake up, I don't say, I am a Muslim Pakistani American. I simply say, I have to pay my bills, all right? But by virtue of having a multi-syllabic last name of Wajahat Ali, my name already is politicized, it's charged, because of the environment in which I live in. I cannot escape it. The environment which I live in informs and electrifies my personality, my identity. So even if I want to be just a writer who happens to be an American, the second I step out onto a Commonwealth panel and they say, Wajahat Ali, someone listening will say, Wajahat Ali? Ali is a Muslim name. And all of a sudden, the images that they have in their mind, the characters they have in their mind, all that baggage now I have to confront and deal with. And so the characters in the play, much like Muslim Americans living now, have to engage a world in which many times they just want to be like regular people. They want to pay their bills, have good relationships, not talk to their mother-in-law too much. But at the same time, they realize that their neighbor might look at them as a suspect and not as a neighbor. that their last name will raise security alerts and alarms at airports, that Somali immigrant family now has to deal with the fact that maybe all these Somali teenagers in that community will now be racially profiled. And now how does that inform your identity and your narrative and your story? Can you escape it? Even if you want to escape it, you cannot, because the society and the culture that you live in is so charged that you have to confront it on a daily basis. And this is what makes some of us slightly paranoid from time to time. We could talk about that later.
You know, Navja, Sol, your work really doesn't directly take on these things. You write poetry, you're a photographer. Yet we were talking before we came out here a little bit that still every place you go, you're dealing with the fact that this is where you come from. You're also an out lesbian, which probably really breaks molds and stereotypes about what people are going to think of as an Iranian American. And, you know, does that affect your work, though, in some way? Is it present?
Two quick corrections. It's Najva.
I'm sorry.
You got it right all the rest of the time. I identify as queer, which is even more confusing. Lesbian, I think my mom would understand. Queer, she's like, what is queer? What does that mean? And then you try to get into the political and radical implications in the gender nonconformity, and it's just a little bit over the head. But in terms of my work, I have been writing and taking photos since high school, and I was never surrounded by Middle Eastern people, ever. I mean, I just had a show last week about the Middle East, and one person in the audience was Middle Eastern, except for the friend that I brought, and I stood there, and I had to explain the Quran and how the Quran used to be a feminist text, and that it wasn't just woman-hating, and that, you know, and because of my privilege of being so alternative, I end up in these situations with people who just have these, you know, I end up getting asked some really hard questions. Like, how can any Muslim ever be, you know, like, don't all Muslims hate women? Isn't Iran a horrible place to be a woman? How can you go there? You know, and I lived there for a while when I was a child, and I traveled there, and I have to like sit and explain and be like, you know, when the Quran was written, women were treated very poorly, and people had multiple wives anyway, but they didn't actually treat them well. So then the Quran came along and was like, no, you actually have to be nice to all of your wives, and you have to treat them all equally, or you can't have more than one. And, you know, it didn't say that you needed to do a lot of the things that are required by the Islamic Republic. Those are different ways to deal with a text, but that's not necessarily in the text. So I've had to answer a lot of questions. I also took a class at the New School where I did my undergrad called Iran, Politics, People, Culture. And I was the only Iranian in the class. I was the only Middle Eastern in the class. And so it was that another case of being that person where you're like, I'm going to answer all the questions now. I don't know if anyone's been the only one in a certain situation. It's just, that's what happens when you write about something that, or like when my work isn't overtly Iranian, so I just end up in all of these situations that are just like crazy.
I'm curious, does it... When that happens to you, does it make you feel like you do want to express yourself in some way and that part of your identity, or does it make you continue to feel like your work really deals with themes around sexuality, you know, becoming a full person? It doesn't, you know, being a woman, it doesn't really deal with, you know, your ethnic identity at all, or your religious background.
So a lot of my poems are dealing with sexuality, difficulties in childhood and parents' divorce, typical American stories that any child would have, being alienated, maybe, you know, doing things your parents didn't approve of, going out on your own, trying to be an artist in this economy.
All of which is tough stuff.
Getting a poetry MFA. But I don't mind talking and answering the questions, because I don't feel as though I can answer questions on a larger scale. Like, I'm not here to tell you about everything Iran. I'm not I'm not like a professor. I didn't live there my entire life. But what I can do is familiarize you with stories that you might not know and also make them palpable to you, because I'm telling you so many other stories that you already understand. So you maybe trust my story as like, I'm coming at it from your point of view. We're both gay. Here, you can hear this from me, but you wouldn't necessarily hear this from someone else. Or, look, we both have weird haircuts. Maybe you'll get this. Or, I'm in your poetry program. Like, don't worry, I'm not one of those political people. Whatever. So I don't mind answering questions, but I can imagine that some people definitely feel stuck in these types of situations where you constantly have to explain yourself. Not everyone. The great thing about being a white American man is that you never have to explain being a white American man. I think Wajahat Ali might have brought that up before.
It's interesting. I wonder if in your future work that'll become more of an issue for you as you grow older. But we have another panelist here, Zoe Ferraris, who married into a Muslim family, spent time living in Saudi Arabia, and now you have two novels out, mystery novels, which definitely take on cross-cultural issues and take on the issue of gender, which in Saudi Arabia is very much, people are very segregated, and yet they're together, and you take on these issues. I wonder a little bit if you thought of yourself, or if you think of yourself more as an outsider looking in. Do you think of yourself as somebody who is coming from, who's in two places because you have a child, you go back there all the time, and spend time there?
I think I feel like an outsider, partly because I'm a white American who grew up in the military. And but I also, it's reinforced all the time by people asking me questions like, you know, why did you write a book about a man from Saudi Arabia? So there's always that pressure that kind of keeps me humble. I definitely, you know, I wrote the book just purely out of going there as a young woman, ignorant of the culture, despite having been married to an Arab man for a couple years. I still didn't know what to expect when I got there, and I think I just always had this notion of those poor Saudi women are so oppressed by evil male tyrants. And I got there and saw a much more complicated situation, you know, involving gender dynamics and what gender segregation does to both genders. And I actually felt a lot more sympathy often for the men, so much so that when I got back and decided to write a book about it, I wanted to write from a man's perspective. That's the perspective that I really empathize with. And both genders, actually. But, you know, the one, the like you were saying earlier, I feel like there's an identity about Saudis that's constructed in Saudi Arabia by Saudis, and then there's, you know, millions of identities, for God's sake. But then there's also the identity that we construct here about them that's maybe completely different. And coming back, I lived here for a number of years and just got all kinds of questions that were, you know, that revealed to me that people didn't understand the basics, you know, just and were where I was before I went there or even further away from it, you know, in terms of just very simple things about what it means to be a Muslim. What is a Muslim? There was even a lot of confusion about, you know, the Hinduism versus Islam, you know, like the very basics that today we definitely know a lot more in general as a culture, but 10 years ago it wasn't as, you know, people just didn't know as much. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I wrote my novel just very, very specifically for an American audience that doesn't know anything about Saudi Arabia, that, you know, I want to provide a portal. And if you're going to read a book and escape somewhere else, I want, you know, to take you to a place that you probably would otherwise never go and present you with a story that will give you a little bit of understanding of complexity rather than, you know, just the dark sort of recesses of not knowing anything at all, you know. I'm particular about gender dynamics over there.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting to a lot of Americans, and there are a lot of ideas about it. It did strike me as I was reading City of Veils, that there was a sense that the men were restrained in ways they wanted to be able to open up and talk to, you know, talk to a woman, and that the conventions really restrained them, and you can feel that in the book. It seems like you're trying to say something about how hard that is actually, because you have a relationship that's thwarted by it. It made me think of Jane Austen, actually. You know, you have this relationship that's kind of thwarted by social convention. They can't really talk to each other.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I have experiences with my in-laws where, you know, I watch my ex-husband. He loves his sisters very much, and then oftentimes doesn't know very basic things about them. And it's almost like, you know, their household is very segregated, and it's just a sort of a mechanical problem. Like, he has to make a little bit of an extra effort to go in and talk to them and spend time with them. And I, you know, I'll be sitting there, I'll be, you know, in that world thinking, my goodness, this is so, you know, look, he doesn't even talk to his sisters anymore or something. And then I'll come home and, like, Thanksgiving dinner in my family. And, you know, at one moment I'll look around, the men are all sitting in the other room watching a ball game, and, you know, the women are all in the kitchen yakking away about pie recipes. And I'm like, oh gosh, you know, that really happens here too. And I think that that actually is part of why my book has worked really for an American audience, is that these themes are universal. You know, the differences between the genders, the struggles that go on are universal. They're slightly different in Saudi Arabia because of conventions, because of traditions, but they're fundamentally the same sorts of issues, you know.
You said that people came away, though, after reading your book, and it sometimes in a way that you didn't want them to come away, which is it made them still feel more frightened of Saudi Arabia. And I think that's a culture that particularly brings up a lot of fear because of the enormous segregation there. But that some people didn't come away quite with the message you'd hoped.
Yeah, that's true. I get, you know, occasionally people will say, wow, I'm never going to go there as a tourist. You know, like, they're just like, it freaks them out. Like, certain things just freak them out. And I kind of feel like, you know, books, it's kind of like, you let it go at some point. It's the reader, it's the democracy of the reader is going to make the vote ultimately on what your book is and how important it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can intend something, but that doesn't mean that's what somebody's going to get out of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Not. Now, I know, Reza, you're living down in Hollywood right now.
Yes. I'm a Bay Area transplant.
Right. I don't know what you're doing down there. I was wondering, are you trying to
do, Causing trouble.
Causing trouble. You know, and one place certainly that a lot of the images that we get are from Hollywood, from movies, and I think we get a pretty narrow vision of the Middle East and Muslim culture. And I know we talked a little bit, the four of us, I don't think you were part of this conversation, about what it's like to actually try and get something into Hollywood or get them to look at something that is different from what they think of. I don't know if you're doing anything like that down there, so I'm going to ask you
That's
whether or not...
That's precisely what I'm doing down there, as a matter of fact. And we've been enormously successful in doing so. The thing that you have to understand about Hollywood is that they don't care about anything except money. They don't have any kind of moral qualms about showing any, if they think that they could make money about a movie where a guy just juggles dead cats for 2 hours, that's exactly what they will do. So what we do, what my company, BoomGen Studios, which is it's a mini motion picture studio, we work on developing and marketing and producing creative content that is either from or about the Middle East, is we show up with a very simple statistic, and it's about how incredibly, ridiculously, absurdly rich Muslims in this country are. I mean, the median income for a Muslim household in America is larger than for a non-Muslim household. 60% of Muslims in this country own their own homes. The advertising giant JWT says that the combined annual disposable income for Muslim Americans is $170 billion. And that's all that matters. And what all they want to know is, how do we get that money? How do we get that? And we tell them how to get it by developing films in which, you know, Muslims aren't caricatures, in which, you know, there are real three-dimensional people, and it's working. It's really remarkable, I think, the way that it has been working. There's been a perceptible shift in the kinds of movies that are coming out about the region over the last decade than previously. But I also think that the American consumer is also thirsting for something different. I mean, I have to be honest with you. I and Norton and who published this book, and Words Without Borders, the organization that I worked with on this. It's an organization that translates literature from around the world in every language imaginable, and puts it up on the website, wordswithoutborders.org, for English speakers all over the world to read for free. And all of the revenue from this book goes to Words Without Borders as well. I think what we've realized is that people are actually really desperate for this information. And people want to read these kinds of stories. I had an interviewer when I first started touring with this book tell me flat out, Americans don't read American poetry. How the hell are you going to get them to read poetry, you know, from the Middle East?
Yeah. Well, they read Rumi.
They read Rumi, that's for sure. But they are reading this stuff, and they are recognizing it, because what they're doing is they're recognizing the sort of these intimate connections that they have with these people on the other side of the world, people that... you know, as Zoe was saying, are seen in these caricatures, you know, that they're frightening or whatever. But that's the power of the arts, is it really allows you to have an intimate encounter, a one-on-one encounter with people. And short of having every American go to the Middle East and visit, the arts, literature, music, film, television, these are really the only means at our disposal to know the people of this region.
I mean, I will have to say that for myself, in reading some of the work, in all cases, it opened my eyes to things that I hadn't thought about, and in good, really good ways. You know, getting a glimpse, you know, into the life of a Pakistani immigrant family. You know, I hadn't done that, not in that way, not in the way that one experiences art and literature. It really gives you much more insight and empathy into the characters. So I think it is important. But I know, you know, here you've had probably less success on some of the panel members in terms of your experiences in dealing with Hollywood or dealing with the entertainment industry. Correct? You've tried with your novel. You've said you've had some, especially with the Veiled Women in Veils.
My agent tried for a long time to find someone to make my first novel into a movie and a production company, whatever. And she approached almost everyone in Hollywood, and they all said no, and they all said no sort of independently and for similar reasons, and they all had to do with the complete inability to find a female actress in Hollywood who would be willing to wear a veil for any part of a movie when her face wasn't showing. But we actually talked about this earlier, the question of, like, you know, what makes it difficult to get these stories that we're telling, to get them out there? You know, is it us? Like, is there a struggle with our lives, or is it like there's these gatekeepers out there? And I feel like there are gatekeepers. In fact, we were just talking about you were saying about your friend Willow, I guess, or maybe somebody.
We weren't supposed to say her
name.
Oh,
right. Okay, I'm sorry.
My friend Kate. Yeah, it's okay. Thank you for giving me the baton. So I have an interesting story with Hollywood. I just came back from Hollywood 2 weeks ago, where I went to my first Hollywood party, and I think they thought I was the kid from Slumdog Millionaire. And everyone gave me like two double looks, and then they figured out I wasn't him, and then no one talked to me, which was interesting. But to bounce off of Reza's point, I think you have to realize, both in New York in the theater world and in Hollywood, the movie world, the color that ultimately matters is green. And what they want to see is, how can we market and sell your product? Now, the thing is this, if I may be blunt at Commonwealth, some of us who are considered ethnic, it's a code word for not white. Okay, and mainstream is a code word for white. Okay, so sometimes Hollywood has said to me and some other people here, how can your very ethnic story be, you know, relatable to the mainstream audience? Translation: you have brown people in your play. White person in Midwest might be terrified by brown people. And so is that something that my white
people.
Yeah, that's something that my white artists, friends, filmmakers never ever get asked. Ever. Even though we live in a globalized world. It's interesting. And so sometimes you need, like, someone like Zoe, like, I call her, like, the Daywalker Blade, one who works, like, you know, because sometimes I feel like you need someone like a translator, right? Like, that's our stories need someone who, we need a filter to translate it. So a story about that is, a producer in Hollywood loved the play, a white guy, really nice, and I think it's not born from malice. I think it's cultural ignorance, which hopefully we could talk about later. It's not malice or racism. I think it's just cultural ignorance. And he says, hey, I love the play. who are we going to cast as the Pakistani immigrant father? And I'm like, I don't know. How about a Pakistani actor? He goes, I have an idea. I'm like, who's your idea? Ted Danson. And so I started laughing, and I'm like, that's hilarious. And there was silence on the phone line, right? And his reasoning was, he goes, America likes Ted Danson. He's safe. And I said, you can cast Ted Danson when I could get cast as Abraham Lincoln. But that just, though, that's a different conversation altogether.
Well, I think, you know, this has happened with other ethnic groups, of course. You know, where, you know, Chinese people are suddenly David Carradine, or, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon.
We're not unique.
I think. Yeah, exactly.
You're not unique as a minority.
Right. Well, this is what I was saying about your play, how striking it is when you read it. You know, I have not had the privilege yet of seeing it perform, but how much you feel like, oh, yeah, this is the immigrant story. This is the same thing, you know, that my grandparents went through, or that so many people go through, and the same thing, it seems, in Hollywood. Now, hopefully Reza is working, you know, on the scene there so that there's more reception. I was going to ask you, when you say that you think things have changed so much, how? How? You know, like, what headway are you making?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I think Hollywood's run out of stories. So I take meetings in which producers just say all the time, tell us something. Tell us a story. Give us something, anything. You know, the last movie that we worked on was Prince of Persia. And what was really amazing about that was that, you know, yes, of course, I mean, none of the actors were actually Persian. Which I don't know why that confused people. I mean, it's a $200 million Disney movie. Did you think, like, some random Iranian guy was going to be Jake Gyllenhaal? Of course not. That's just how Hollywood works. Right. But the fact that they tapped into, you know, a 2,000-year-old, you know, mythology from Iran, no less, and created this massive, you know, summer blockbuster out of it, is incredible. It would have been unimaginable 10 years ago. So, you know, you go from, you know, the movie 300 to the movie Prince of Persia, and that, I think, is a very good example of the shift that's taking. You can't make 300 again because the Middle Eastern community is flexing its muscles as a consumer market, and it's making it very clear that it will only stand, you know, for so much. And that's just, you know, money talks in this country.
It does. Green being the most important color. You know, one. I wanted to get back to one of your poems, which actually was about what if poets were great celebrities. So I don't know, as a poet, how much you know, in our culture, there usually aren't the hugest celebrities. Alas, no. I wish poets were. Whether you've come up against this kind of, I guess.
Where do you fit with this whole Hollywood?
Yeah,
money
where do you
thing?
Fit with this whole Hollywood thing?
I don't. I've never tried to pitch anything to Hollywood, but other things that, I wrote a review about 300. So, and I remember writing about it from the point of view of the Persian consumer, and how most people I knew wouldn't see it. They refused to give their money to it. I remember playing Prince of Persia also when I was in first grade on the computer. It was a computer game that I was quite fond of, and I was confused about Jake Gyllenhaal, but now I get it, right? Jake Gyllenhaal equals green. You know, one of the really interesting things I think Reza Aslan was talking about was the connection and all the different forms of art and literature being the way that we can connect to these Middle Eastern places, and why those are so important. And one of the really interesting things that I've stumbled upon is the blogosphere, and how, I don't know if people are aware, but Farsi is one of the most used languages on the internet. Mm-hmm. Now, it's right, you probably don't have the chance to pick up the phone and call someone from Iran, and you also probably don't speak Farsi. However, there are translators, and I was just thinking, so as a poet, I sit here and I'm like, what if this and what if that? But like, what if the, what was that organization that funded, that did all the translations for your book?
Words Without Borders.
Okay, that's what I thought it was. I didn't want to get it wrong. But Words Without Borders, you know, there are, so Iranian people can't you know, at times text messaging has been turned off in the country. At times, you know, every newspaper gets shut down. The information coming out of that country really only has one source, and that's the internet. And even still, they're just really, really good hackers, because the median age in that country is like 35. Everyone is really smart and educated, and they don't have anything to do with it. So they go online. And so there's just masses and masses of blogs written in Farsi about the Farsi experience. And there's no publishers going there to be like, let me, there is a great book by Persis Karim called Let Me Tell You Where I've Been on the Iranian Diaspora. And she's, you know, that anthology is great, but this, the like raw untapped information, like, I wonder what would happen if that was translated. You know, those stories of those kids that are in the country. And that was like what I was thinking of when you were talking about all the ways to interact, because that's a disconnect where there's all this information from young Iranians and probably other young Middle Eastern. I don't know the prevalence of other languages on the internet, like Arabic, but there's a lot of blogs being written about what it's like right now. And like, the access to that, like Google Translate can sometimes
work. That's what's so great about this book. We don't get enough translation
of
literature and things that are written in Middle Eastern countries. I want to say in 5 minutes, we're going to go to questions from the audience. So think up your questions and try and come up with one good question that you'd like to ask the panelists, and take a minute and do that. And I wanted to ask you all, I think we kind of said maybe that there was kind of one little thing you wanted to say about the work you're doing and your writing, and you were going to kind of bring one little thing you wanted to, point you wanted to make.
Do you want to start?
Okay,
so the most terrifying thing for me wasn't being an Iranian person coming to an American audience. Like, that was not hard. The hardest part for me was being someone who was very firmly rooted in underground and alternative culture in the American sense, and then trying to take that and show that to my family and friends and relatives and members of the Iranian and Middle Eastern communities, especially as a person who is out. If you research queer Iranian, queer Middle Eastern artists, you get almost nothing, because it is still a offense that is not only haram, but it's also punishable by death. And I wonder if I can go back to Iran now. You know, there's Tara Inanlu, which is like this 21-year-old photographer in London who just got, accepted. What's the word when you're allowed to stay in the country and you don't have to go back for fear of death?
Asylum?
Yeah, she just got granted asylum. But it was really, really hard. I just had my first solo photo show in Maryland with all of the members of every Persian organization that my family knows, coming to see it. And there's naked people, and there's people's tattoos and piercings. And it was an amazing experience and terrifying. That's what I mean. The whole cultural, cross-cultural thing goes both ways. And if you feel more firmly rooted in the more American side of it, then it's like hard to cross back over into where, you know, you feel like you come from, but you want to be yourself. It goes both ways. So that's
me. Uh-huh.
So I think it was you were told us in 60 seconds how we can change the world.
Well, no, this is specifically more your. We'll get to that. We'll get
Never
to
mind.
That.
Not
yet.
Not
this
that.
Is just more something that you feel you wanted to share about, you know, being a writer.
I obviously, first of all, don't pay attention as a writer, so I need to listen
more.
Yeah,
well, there's that.
Maybe if we had some coffee, Commonwealth. I'm just, it was
There'll
my fault.
There'll be wine
It was
later,
my
I
fault. Liz, okay. As a writer, okay, what I would like to share is this as a writer, and I know how we were critical about Hollywood and the industry. I want to be self-critical about our communities, and hopefully on a positive note. Many Muslim Americans and many minority groups, they complain about the quote-unquote media, whatever the media is. It's just the media, oh, the media, they're against us. So I always ask, are you doing anything to change it? And the question is, well, no, but I watch the media. Then I'm like, you have lost your privilege and license to complain to me in this day and age. Because if you're not doing anything to engage and proactively change the media, the narrative and stories will never change. So what I want to say is, for, as a writer, I have benefited tremendously through just simply engaging. I've reached out my hand and I've found friends across the aisle, whether it be an all-boys Catholic school, whether it be in England when I write for The Guardian, whether it be through Jewish Americans who say we need cross-cultural dialogue. There are people there on the other side of the aisle that you might find who are your enemies who are actually very interested, as Reza was saying, to learn and to help engage one another. And so if you engage, and that's what I always tell people is there's so much power in the pen. You know, my law degree didn't take me to Australia or to Abu Dhabi or to New York to perform the play. It was my pen. I wrote my pen. And there's so much power in the pen, even though it is not the holy trinity of doctor, engineer, dubious businessman who somehow makes a lot of money.
Lawyer?
Or lawyer. It's Same very pen. Empowering. And I hope that those people from those quote-unquote minority communities who have no value in this say to their child who could be the next Rumi, who should not be an engineer, who should be the next Rumi, hey, you have talent, pick up that pen. Maybe your story will benefit.
I'm gonna ask you guys to try and go quick because we want to get to questions.
Sorry.
So Zoe, you have a quick,
good,
a quick thought?
I don't really have any.
Reza, mm-hmm. any quick thoughts on?
Just, you know, what I've been saying so far is that, you know, we'd like to think that education changes people's minds and that education reframes perceptions, but unfortunately it's not actually true. Data, information doesn't change the way people think. Relationships changes the way people think. So, again, short of, you know, going out or, you know, particularly in this day and age where anti-Muslim sentiment is you know, at such unprecedented levels, short of having every Muslim go door-to-door and introduce themselves, which I do not recommend, you know, the way that we're going to sort of recognize Islam and Muslims as very much a part of the religious fabric that makes this mm-hmm. country what it is through relationships. And that's really, really the key. And relationships, I think, come through stories.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just thinking, right. It's just sugar, really. I'm just bringing over.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a,
no,
be tough.
Don't
so
do that. And definitely don't do it in Oklahoma.
Yeah, not a good idea. So questions. We have a mic over here. And if you can just wander over to the mic and... here we have somebody right here. Please.
I commend you for a very interesting talk, but I wondered if there were any Israeli authors in your anthology?
There's no Hebrew in the anthology for a very important reason. The anthology is 1910 to 19, or to 2010, and the important thing for us was that all the writing had to be done in the Middle East. And the fact of the matter is that really until about the 1950s, the locus of Hebrew literature was not in the Middle East. It was in Russia and Eastern Europe. By the time it does shift to the Middle East, by the time you get this amazing flowering of Hebrew literature coming out of Israel in the 50s and 60s, with a couple of exceptions, certainly some amazing exceptions, the majority of that literature tends to deal with themes that really do not go hand in hand at all with the larger themes of the writings that are coming out in the region about identity formation, about pushing back against the West, about, you know, cultural criticism. Indeed, the vast majority of the writing that comes out during that time tends to be clearly focused on sort of Jewish and Israeli historical destiny. So as a result, I offer two or three really fabulous collections of contemporary Hebrew and contemporary Israeli writing in the book, but it was a decision that this writing came so late and was so different from the rest of the writing in the region that it just did not fit.
Forgive me, I didn't mean Hebrew, I meant Israeli, because I think about half of the Jews that live in Israel are Arab-speaking, and there are also Muslim
that's right.
Israelis and Christian Israelis. So
that's right. This is not an anthology of Muslim literature. That's very important to understand. It's not an anthology of literature from the Muslim world, first of all, because there is no such thing as the Muslim world.
Yes.
And second of all, because a lot of these writers either don't identify themselves as Muslim. Many of the writers are Christian. A few of them are Jewish. And certainly many of the quote-unquote sort of Palestinian writers were writing from the state of Israel, not from the occupied territories. That's correct.
We have other questions. And before we just take one more question, I just want to do a reminder here that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inform Division, and tonight we're hosting an evening of conversation with political analyst and author Reza Aslan, playwright Rajahat Ali, author Zoe Ferraris, and poet-photographer Najwa Sol. Sir, you have a question.
Yes. As I was listening to all of your stories, it seemed to me that you're not only writers, but also translators. In addition to, like, the literal translation in Reza's book, you're all translating languages in the broadest sense. And at two different levels. On one hand, in terms of your writing, translating from these different traditions into a discourse American readers can understand, and then also in your personal lives, in that there's a cross of different identities. I was wondering if in this project translation, you feel a tension between personal goals and social, even marketing goals. Like, what's important to you in an Islamic and American heritage might be different from what the media is interested in. And I was wondering if how you handle that tension.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for everyone giving it to me. I appreciate that. Well, thank you for that thesis question. It actually is a very intelligent question. There is that tension. There is that tension between how can I tell my story the way I want to tell it, which is authentic and personal, but also I have to communicate that story to a global audience, right? Because if you're not able to communicate your story, then you get to read it. Congratulations. Which is fine. You get to have your diary. But I've always told people that my audience has always been a multicultural global audience for everything that I've ever written. Multicultural, global. So even though the characters in the play might be Pakistani, immigrant, Muslim, my audience is you. Or my audience is the Middle East, or my audience is Europe. And so what I have to do, the test for me, and what I've seen, and I stick by this, is if you create a story which is interesting with characters that are captivating, then an audience will stick with it. If the values like Zoe was talking about are universal, it will resonate with a global audience. So it's my job as a writer to employ that skill or develop that skill, well, where I can at the same time not compromise my values, whether it be Islamic, political, cultural, where I feel like I haven't sold out, whatever that means, in communicating the story for a multicultural global audience. I hope that answered it.
Good storytelling is good storytelling.
Good storytelling is good storytelling, exactly.
In the end, there's nothing like a good yarn to draw most people in. Another question from the audience. No questions. Goodness.
We did such a good job of saying everything.
If not, then I'm going to follow up on something, which is the idea of that you brought up, Najwa, of bringing back things to the Middle East from this culture and that interaction the other way around. And Zoe, you travel back to Saudi Arabia, and I'm wondering how much of that you see happening. Do you see interest there in writing that's happening here that's beyond sort of, I don't know how much they get of Hollywood entertainment, which seems to go everywhere, but even deeper, more interest in the kind of writing you do? How much do you think?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is just how much Hollywood culture has just like dispersed all over the globe. You know, in Saudi Arabia, you can walk into a store. I mean, this is a country where women often veil their faces in public, and there's, you know, the latest DVDs with pictures of, like, you know, DVDs for kids that are, you know, like the Fantastic Four has a practically naked woman on the cover. You know, I mean, it's just that our storytelling is everywhere, and it's you know, definitely there's an interest in it. But I think more than that, there's just a struggle. It becomes an issue of identity in a lot of ways. You know, like, is this ours? Is this something we want to use to define ourselves or not? You know, so it's no longer just like, I mean, a good story is a good story, and everybody's always going to want to hear it. But then there's the question of what it means later, like in terms of yourself and how you think of your culture, you know?
There's one character in your play, the daughter, whose name I can't remember. I mean, she's sort of in this position of trying to reject Western culture and go back to a kind of...
I would disagree with that.
Oh, really? Well, all right.
The daughter's name is Fatima because she's a 24-year-old feisty law student who's an activist, and she decides to voluntarily wear the hijab, which is the head covering. And her mother doesn't approve of that. Her mother's also religious, and she doesn't wear the hijab. And that's a very fascinating point you made, is that some people think, oh, because she's wearing the hijab, which is a religious practice, she's all of a sudden cutting off all ties to a Western identity, which is an audience member. After the first time they saw the play, they said, oh, I was really surprised by that that character, Fatima, who wore the hijab. I thought surely by the end she would be a suicide bomber. We're like, what? which also goes to Zoe's point is that, you know, these cultural icons are politicized, which goes back to your first point. And so she, you know, it exactly goes back to the first point of these complex identities. Just by her putting on a religious garment, she does not stop being this 24-year-old American-born girl who has adopted, inhaled American culture her entire life. It lives side by side. And sometimes what Zoe said, I mean, what I've seen in Saudi Arabia also is they love our culture there. They love it. They know more about our culture than we know about their culture, yes. To tell you the truth. And, I mean, Najwa, you can jump in here.
About Iran. I've never been to Saudi Arabia.
But Iran.
Well, in Iran, American movies are illegal. American music is illegal. The West is illegal. Satellite is illegal. It's all illegal. Just anything America is Satan. And I'm not kidding. When I was in second grade, I was in Iran and I was in school there, and they walked across the American flag to go to class. No joke. I wouldn't do it. I got in trouble. So in Iran, I was American. In America, I was Iranian. It was confusing. But when I got there, one of the interesting things was I could get anything. It was so illegal. It was cheap. You go to a bookstore, right. You know, and there's like a book, and in it is a list. It's like iTunes, except every CD is 99 cents, you know, and you order it and then you come back the next day and you get it. Or there's like someone, if you've seen a movie I would recommend is Nobody Knows About Persian Cats. And you'll see this guy comes around with these DVDs. Blockbuster comes to you in Iran, and he brings all the best new Hollywood movies. So, yes, do they know about American culture? They have, like, you know, satellites that are illegal. Yeah, and I don't know if making it illegal makes it even more interesting, but it's totally pervasive, and they're so interested. But the thing is that, like, they're still listening to only, like, the top pop hits. Like, they don't know about smaller bands, they probably don't know about smaller literature. Like, they only know about the things that here we just sort of go, oh, like, not another Lady Gaga song. No, I love Lady Gaga. But, like, you know, they still might be listening to, like, the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, because those are the things that get translated, the, like, biggest things get translated over there.
Now we have a whole lineup of questions over here.
So, what did we say?
Sir, you have
a
question. Salman.
Thanks a lot for coming out, guys. Just on the note, or on the point about expecting or seeing a trending change in maybe the audience here or in North America towards Middle Eastern content media. Question directly maybe to you, Reza, but you had talked about how, you know, your studio is essentially looking at where you might get the funding to fuel that kind of production. In particular, there's a large amount of people who are Middle Eastern here who have a lot of money. It seemed to me that that would help fund it and that someone might invest in the movie. But what sort of research have you done to really, you know, convince you that the audience is now willing to pay, people are willing to go into the theaters and actually make the movies successful rather than just made?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have, you know, a whole suite of graphs to show the ticket sales and, you know, money invested in these kinds of films. But I do think it's also important to understand that this is a global market that we're talking about. You know, I brought up Prince of Persia, which frankly was disappointing in its American box office, but it was the biggest Disney movie of all time in India. So you have, in a country of 300 million people, it was okay. In a country of a billion people, it was the biggest movie of all time. And I think Disney has understood very, very quickly wait a second, we have a huge audience that goes way beyond just the kind of the popcorn eating Midwesterners here, and that, you know, there is money to be made, you know, outside of this country. So it's not just about the American market; it's a global market.
And so, just to follow up on that, so did you feel that Prince of Persia itself was a result in a changing trend of being more acceptable to those kinds of stories? Because my personal perception was that was a game that was extremely popular that I spent many hours playing, and now there's a movie about it.
True, except that it wasn't marketed as a video game movie, and that's the important thing. You know, they understood that that would be a market for it, but that's not how they marketed it, which I think says a lot.
Let's take another question here.
Hi, thanks for coming out tonight. I'm really enjoying this, and I think it's very informative, and I very much appreciate it. A few years ago, I was married to a Muslim guy, and I ended up going over to live in Sudan outside of Khartoum. I also traveled to Egypt, and I was in Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that was interesting, because I was born here in the United States, and I was raised Muslim here, what I thought was interesting is, and I didn't realize this would happen, and I think all of you have spoken about this tonight, is I saw culture impacting religion. And even though I was in Muslim countries, I saw some variance in terms of the cultures impacting, to some degree, the practice of the religion. Not some of the most fundamental aspects of it, but that culture does play a huge role in, and I guess it would be almost any religion, in how it's somewhat interpreted and practiced in the society. I came back to the United States and realized I don't have to practice as an Arab Muslim because I'm an American. And the culture here impacted how I was feeling about all of that after those travels and living overseas. And so I think you guys have spoken about this. Mm-hmm. What have you noticed in your travels in terms of culture impacting, even though you're in Muslim countries, the various cultures and cultural ways impacting the practice of the religion and, you know, gender, the relation between men and women, that type of thing?
Well, you know, the simple answer to that question is that there is no such thing as religion without culture. And I'm speaking as a scholar of religions. Religions aren't born in vacuums. They're an intimate part of, you know, the cultures, the soil out of which they arise. And particularly this is true of Islam, which is the most diverse religion in the world. You can fly, you know, from Khartoum to Cairo to Islamabad to Tehran to Jakarta, and you'll never see the same Islam twice. And that's true of all religions. If you're an American Christian, you know, living in the suburbs, your Jesus is, first of all, blonde with blue eyes. But secondly, is a turn the other cheek Jesus. Is a Jesus that wants you to be rich. The fastest growing Protestant sect in America is the prosperity gospel, whose purpose is to say that Jesus wants you to be rich. If you're a Christian living in the hills of Guatemala, that Jesus makes no sense to you at all. Your Jesus is a warrior. Your Jesus is a liberator who shows a preferential option for the poor. If you're a Muslim living in America, then, you know, your view of Muhammad is completely different than if you're a Muslim living in Sudan. That's the beauty and the power of religion. And it bothers a lot of people. I think people like to think that, no, the religion should be monolithic. Everyone should, you know, the core values of a particular religion should be the same everywhere. Yeah, well, it's just not the case. I mean, I know that you'd like it to be that way, but it's just not. So it's important. It's very, very important to become culturally literate, not just religiously literate in this globalized world.
Thank you. It just surprised me. It was shocking.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question. So try and make it a quick question.
All right. As quickly as I can be, I tend to disagree with the notion that everything about America in Iran is illegal. I wonder if Reza has any opinion on this.
Well, look, Iran is a developing country. I would even go so far as to say, you know, it's the quintessential third world country, by which I mean the laws in the hands of the bureaucrat in the desk behind you. You know, everything is kind of illegal in Iran, but there is absolutely no limits to the access that Iranians have. They know everything that you know about the world. We're talking about internet usage in Iran. In 5 years, it's jumped 5,000%.
Yeah.
You know, they watch every show that you watch. They love Jersey Shore. They wear blue jeans. They keep up to date with the Harry Potter films. The legality or illegality of things is completely irrelevant in a country like Iran.
Yeah. Well, it all began. If I may advise you, it all began in 1953 when the U.S. government overthrew.
Well, I think we're gonna. We actually have to cut off. Right. I think at the moment. Go ahead.
Every older generation Iranian will tell you that in 1953, America screwed Iran over, and for that we are, you know, we are still angry. The anger.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't mean to make that sound like I was cutting that off because of the topic of the discussion. Yes, this is. I have heard this, and it seems very important when it comes to Iranian-American relationships to understand that there is a very complicated history and anger towards the United States. But I know I was only rushing because I know we have one last thing that we're supposed to do before we finish out
right,
the evening.
Change the world.
Change the world.
That's right.
Which is I have to ask you all, you know, the 60-second answer, what would you do? This is something Inform is doing this year. What would you do if you have 60 seconds and you have to give an idea to change the world? Reza.
I would make it mandatory that part of your college course curriculum is a study abroad. Like, you cannot graduate without a study abroad. Yeah.
Zoe.
Get rid of bureaucrats for a while. And
more to that?
There's one more question there from the audience. But
I think we're just out of time, alas. So
selfless sharing of our stories for a global audience. Stories that are by us for everyone, simultaneously empowering for multicultural communities, and at the same time generous so we engage one another, build relationships, gain cultural awareness, and hopefully make the world a bit more sane.
In 60 seconds, I have two. One practical one, allowing the Bush tax cuts to expire. And one impractical one, which is to force everyone to take life a little bit more lightly. Maybe put some glitter on it, put a costume on, laugh a little bit more. Thanks.
So I want to personally thank the panel. You guys have been terrific. And thank the Commonwealth Club. And I guess we've already given them a big round of applause, but let's give them one more.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.